Well, we're going to start on page 108. I think that is where we left off last week, page 108. But let me read to you something from Deuteronomy chapter 13. This is a portion of scripture that's addressed in this next section. I think it was also addressed in the previous sections that we've looked at on Mormonism. So this is Deuteronomy 13. I believe it does apply to Mormonism and many other cults that have sprung up over the years. But it says, if there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and giveth thee a sign or a wonder. And you know, I might say right there that there have always been those, you know, in every generation that have arose and claimed to be prophets or messengers from God. You know, it's nothing new. I mean, Jesus warned us about this very thing repeatedly in his ministry, and that's why these instructions are still applicable for us today. It says, and the sign or the wonder come to pass whereof he spake unto thee. In other words, he, you know, makes a prophecy, and hey, the prophecy even comes to pass. I mean, we know from other scriptures, if somebody makes a prophecy and it doesn't come to pass, then you can pretty much ignore them because they're not a prophet of God. If they were, their prophecy would not have failed. And by the way, when you look at many of the cults, including the Mormon cult, you'll see prophecies that were foretold that never came to pass. Prophecies by Joseph Smith and others. Therefore, I think we can safely conclude on that basis that they are false prophets. But even if someone was to make a prophecy and it come to pass, because you know what they say, you know, if somebody makes enough prophecies, some of them are likely, you know, to come to pass. As they say, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? So even if the prophet makes a prophecy, it comes to pass, and then he says, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them. Thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God proveth you to know whether ye love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. It's a test. And you can imagine how hard and how difficult this test would be. Someone claims to be a prophet of God. They make a prophecy, and it even comes to pass. And then he tries to steer you away from what you know to be the truth is concerning God. Do you follow? Well, the Bible says no. It's a test of your faith to see whether or not you truly love God. And I think more early Mormons would have done well to heed the advice that's given to us there in the scriptures. But just to review a little bit, because you know, I like to review the things that we cover multiple times, because I know that not everything that we study, not everything that we look at is going to stick. We're not going to remember all of it, at least most of us aren't. But if there are a few things that we can remember, a few things that we could utilize, you know, when we come in contact with Mormons, you know, or people who are being influenced by Mormons. You know, just having a few substantive things, you know, to give to them would be helpful, because, you know, if you rattle off everything that we study here in this particular section, they're unlikely, you know, to remember it all either. So, but if you just have a few things, a few significant things that you can utilize, you know, to help people stay clear of the Mormon cult. And I know as we were covering some things last week, Tammy made a comment. I forget exactly what it was about. But I know in response to it, and this is one of the things that I am making are on purpose trying to remember, because I think it's significant and impactful, and that is that Joseph Smith was arrested for deceiving people, with his peeking stone. He was arrested for deceit. And this peeking stone, he supposedly was using to find buried or hidden treasure. Of course, he failed at that endeavor, but it's that same peeking stone that was used later to supposedly translate the Book of Mormon. I mean, that should make anybody naturally suspicious, right? Because I know if because this last section we looked at was really surrounding the reputation of Joseph Smith and his family. And they did not have a good reputation. You remember the testimony of Mr. Hale, was it? Which was Joseph Smith's father-in-law. You know, he did not have anything good to say about him. Matter of fact, he said that he ran off with his daughter while he wasn't around to put a stop to it. And I know what it was that Tammy had mentioned, because Joseph Smith said he had put away, his earlier ways of seeking after hidden treasure. And so, maybe that's not something to bring up to a Mormon, because even we ourselves can think back to our past, and before we got saved, we probably lived a much different life than we did after we got saved. And so they could always claim the same about Joseph Smith. But again, they should be suspicious about the fact that he's using the same peeking stone that he looked for hidden treasures with to translate the Book of Mormon. So I think those things are important. Also, another interesting point in the last section that we looked at is that there were two sources that testified the Book of Mormon has never been used for archaeological discoveries and things of that nature. And that's also one of the questions at the end of this chapter. But at the bottom of page 99, under little letter A, it says the testimony of the National Geographic Society. And in a letter dated January 11, 1990, the research correspondent for the National Geographic Society testified the Society has never used the Book of Mormon to locate archaeological sites, and we do not believe that any of the places named in the Book of Mormon can be placed geographically by the evidence of archaeology. So, here we have the testimony of the National Geographic Society, and also there is the testimony of the Smithsonian Institute, that's under letter B. They said the Book of Mormon is a religious document and not a scientific guide. The Smithsonian Institution has never used it in archaeological research, and any information that you have received to the contrary is incorrect. So that's the testimony of these two organizations. And I think those are some of the key points, at least from my perspective, to keep in mind in regards to Mormonism. But before we move on, does anybody have any questions or comments in regards to what we've looked at so far? Just looking back over some of the headings of what we've looked at. Also, here's another point I wanted to make to reiterate. Joseph Smith had indicated that he received an Egyptian document that he translated into what was called the Book of Abraham. And this is talked about on pages 102 and 103. He claimed that he had translated a papyrus written by Abraham some 4,000 years ago. But later on, whenever it was able to be examined, and by the way, it had 49 verses, but somehow when Joseph Smith translated it, it had 2,000 words in English. But Egypt, it says there kind of in the middle of page 103, When Egyptologists translated this piece of papyrus, they found that it contained absolutely nothing concerning Abraham. Instead, it turned out to be a pagan funerary text known as the Book of Breathings, a work which actually evolved from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. So, again, I think that's an interesting point. It kind of demonstrates the nature, the deceitful nature of Joseph Smith. So, we did get up through, correct me if I'm wrong, because we may not have covered all this. I just put a check mark there by page 108, but sometimes I do that because that's where I stop reading. But did we get through the death of Joseph Smith? Do you guys remember? You don't remember that?
No, I don't remember anything past.
Let's see if I made another mark. Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, we left off on page 100.
Okay, yeah. I'm 101 and 102 look familiar, but that's
well, let's turn back to page 100. So we probably didn't even cover that. I didn't think that sounded familiar. So we left off with the two institutions that gave no credence to the Book of Mormon, the Smithsonian Institute and the National Geographic Society. So really where we finished up was at point 7, which says that Joseph Smith was a braggart. And I find some of these quotes from him quite interesting. And by the way, these are all documented. You know, Brother Cloud has the sources here indicated, you know, and they're not a source that's opposed to Mormonism. They're from the Mormon documents themselves. And so this first quotation from Joseph Smith came from the History of the Church, you know, Volume 6 there. It even has the date of this sermon, which was May 26, 1844. He says, "Come on, ye prosecutors, ye false swearers, all hell boil over. Ye burning mountains, roll down your lava, for I am come out on top at last. I have more to boast of than ever any man had. I am the only man that has ever been able to keep a whole church together since the days of Adam. A large majority of the whole have stood by me. Neither Paul, John, Peter, nor Jesus ever did it. I boast that no man ever did such a work as I."
Ye.
Wow.
No, I've heard some.
That alone makes him.
And by the way, I've heard some Baptist preachers say similar things, but but you know, they don't claim to be the, you know, a leader like the Pope or Joseph Smith or such things.
I hope they don't drag Jesus in it.
I've never seen him do. I've never seen him do that, but. He says in that next quote, "But I am learned and know more than all the world put together."
How about that?
"The Holy Ghost does anyhow, and he is within me and comprehends more than all the world, and I will associate myself with him. I have now preached a little Latin, a little Hebrew, Greek, and German."
That's only four languages.
Well, if he had the Holy Ghost in him, he would be uplifting Christ, not himself.
Yeah, not himself. But the next point there is number 8. It said that Smith carried a magic talisman. Is that how you pronounce that? "When Joseph Smith was shot to death, he had in his pocket a magic charm representative of the pagan god Jupiter." I mean, you read the history of Joseph Smith and the Mormon Church, they just seem to be interested in all these relics and documents and that really were insignificant, you know. These old texts, you know, they thought they were important just because they were in a different language. Point number 9 says he was a liar and an adulterer in a sermon dated May 26, 1844. That was the same sermon that that quote before was taken from. Smith testified that he had only one wife, whereas in reality he had dozens. But consider what he said. What a thing it is for a man to be accursed of committing adultery, or accused of committing adultery and having seven wives, when I can only find one. And then that next point in reality, Smith had privately proclaimed to his inner circle that previous marriages were null and void, and that previously married women were free to take new marriages. It says that he had some 48 wives, and several other Mormon leaders had also contracted multiple new wives. And later on in the book, you know, we'll get to the sections that outline this and outline this. I mean, and I don't know that anybody can refute it, you know. Like I said, I've been to Brigham Young's house in Salt Lake City, Utah, and, you know, the little Mormon girls that do the tours, you know, point out where the main wife was and then the other wives were. I mean, they taught and practiced polygamy. But what we'll also find is that not everybody, you know, who was a Mormon practiced or adhered to their doctrine of polygamy. And when we get to the section after Joseph Smith's death and then the offshoots that came as a result, you'll see that some were opposed to these doctrines, but others weren't. And so, you know, don't think that the Mormon Church is one cohesive unit, because it's not. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of splinter groups of Mormons, just many of them have very few followers. You know, probably some of the, I don't know if you've ever paid attention to the things that show up on current events, but, you know, it's probably been 10 years ago that there were some arrests made on a particular compound out west, you know, where a Mormon sect, polygamy sect, lived. There wasn't a lot of them, but they did live out there. And so there's all kinds of sects and groups, probably two main groups of Mormons today, at least from what I've read so far.
Does the Book of Mormon teach polygamy?
I haven't found it yet, but of course I haven't gotten through it very far, so. But, you know, they
don't...
I wonder
how they could throw out a doctrine if it's taught in that.
Well, and another thing we'll see later on is there are really five books that they see as authoritative. The Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price, the Doctrines and Covenants, and then I'm missing one. But there's, you know, basically five books that are viewed as authoritative. So even their Doctrines and Covenants. But I doubt that their Doctrines and Covenants would say that today, because, you know, at least the larger Mormon church doesn't practice polygamy. But, you know, Brigham Young sure did, and we'll see some quotes from him, you know, that I think he says you can't be exalted, you know, without practicing polygamy. But we'll get to that later on. But that was one, that's one thing I'm curious to see, whether or not the Book of Mormon would teach and promote polygamy. But under number 10, Smith's claim to be able to perform miracles was bogus. Example, he did, however, announce that on a certain evening, about twilight, he would walk on water. Now this is interesting. The place of his selection was watched by Gentile boys until one of Smith's followers was seen to construct a bridge of planks just under the surface. So he was plotting to walk on water, but it was all deceit. And watching their opportunity, the boys removed the outer planks. So that was very wise of them. Before the prophet made the attempt to walk, he exhorted his followers to have strong faith. And when his bridge suddenly gave way, he swam ashore and said, "Woe to you of little faith.
That's right.
Your faith would not hold up. Wow. If you're like me, you know, again, as I the whole point of studying this, well, maybe there's two points. You don't want to be led astray yourself, but that's at this point in my life and ministry, that's not going to happen. So I'm reading it in hopes that I can effectively minister to people who are trapped in Mormonism, in particular, Marcia and Cody. And I keep thinking to myself, there's so many of these things you could bring up. And yet, what would a faithful Mormon likely do when you brought them up? Just dismiss them. They just dismiss them. You know, they'd have these blinders on and not willing to listen. Or at least that's the way it would appear. But you still have to try. You still have to bring these things up. Because over time, I think it does make a difference. And by the way, when you minister to people, when you talk to them and they just refuse to open their eyes, point that out to them. Say, you know what, you can tell them, you don't have to listen to anything I'm saying. You know, you can just dismiss it with blind faith if you choose, if that's what you want to do. But understand, you're choosing to close your eyes. You're choosing not to look into this. And if you're true love and desire is for the truth, you shouldn't be afraid to look into it. Because if you look into it and you find that this information is correct and it's right and you've been deceived, now you can escape. But if, like you think, you're right, then you'll discover that it's all bogus and fraudulent and it doesn't hurt to look into it. But Smith's claims to be able to read ancient languages was bogus. It says, this is a quote, that the prophet was not well advanced either in Greek or English appears from a story related by the Reverend Henry Caswell, who visited Navo, Illinois in 1842. He had with him a copy of the Psalter in Greek, which he handed to the prophet and asked him to explain its contents. Smith looked at it a few moments, and then he replied, which I don't know if this is a direct quote or not, but no, it ain't Greek at all, except perhaps a few words. What ain't Greek is Egyptian, and what ain't Egyptian is Greek. This book is very valuable. It is a dictionary of Egyptian hieroglyphics. Pointing to the capital letters at the beginning of each verse, he said, them figures is Egyptian hieroglyphics, and them which follows is the interpretation of the hieroglyphics written in the Reformed Egyptian. I'm skipping down to the last part. The prophet then attempted to buy the book on the ground that it could be of no use to Caswell because he did not understand it. Of course, he knew what the book was, and so he knew that Smith was lying. He claimed in the next page, Smith claimed that he had translated a papyrus written by Abraham, this is what I mentioned earlier, thinking we had gotten through it, some 4,000 years ago, titled The Book of Abraham. It was accepted by the Mormon Church as scripture and was published as a part of the Pearl of Great Price. One thing I kept wondering as I read that, whether or not it was still included in that, you know, especially knowing what we know now about this document. Okay, so here in my Book of Mormon, it does not have the Pearl of Great Price, so I can't. But that I'd be interested to know whether or not it's still included in that, because as it says here, they thought that this document was lost in the Chicago fire in 1871. Smith's collection of papyri was discovered by the Metropolitan Museum of Art and returned to the Mormon Church in 1967. And so then a careful examination by linguists proved that Smith's translation was bogus. His translation of less than four lines from the papyrus became 49 verses of more than 2,000 words in English. They said that it had absolutely nothing to do with Abraham. It was just this pagan funerary text known as the Book of Breathings. Skipping down a little bit, it's filled with magic and pagan gods. The fact that the papyrus Joseph Smith used as the basis for this Book of Abraham is in reality the Book of Breathings cannot be disputed, because the name Book of Breathings appears clearly on the fourth line of the fragment. Skipping a couple more lines, the papyrus says, after his two arms are fastened to his breast, one wraps the Book of Breathings, which is with writing both inside and outside of it, with royal linen, it being placed at his left arm near his heart, this having been done at his wrapping and outside it. So you can see, you know, what this document actually says. It says in one case, Joseph Smith derived 177 English words out of the word Khons, the name of an Egyptian moon god. And so he said, is it possible to escape the conclusion that the Book of Abraham is a product of Joseph Smith's imagination? So again, that's why I say, to me, this is one of the more significant points made in this book, in this section so far. Because you had him translate a book that he called the Book of Abraham. It was accepted by the Mormon Church as divine revelation, but it was proven later to be false. So what does a Mormon say about that? And shouldn't it make you suspicious then about what the Mormon Church says about other documents? Especially in light of the fact that the Book of Mormon was translated from the speaking stone that was used to find hidden treasure. Any comments or questions about that before we move on? This next section says the Kinderhook plate forgery. Shortly before May of 1843, a man brought six brass plates containing a semblance of Egyptian writing to Joseph Smith, claiming he had discovered them in a mound of dirt through guidance he had received in a dream. Smith was excited about the plates and claimed that he would translate them through revelation. He soon claimed that he had succeeded in translating a portion of the writing and that the plates contained the history of the person with whom they were found, and he was a descendant of Ham through the loins of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and that he received his kingdom from the ruler of heaven and earth. Under letter C, in January of 1844, the Mormon publication Times and Seasons even claimed that the plates helped prove the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Notice what they said. Why does the circumstance of the plates recently found in a mound in Pike County, Illinois, by Mr. Riley, together with ethnology and a thousand other things, go to prove the Book of Mormon true? His answer? Because it is true. In fact, though, the plates were a forgery by some men who wanted to play a trick on Smith. On January 30th, 1879, W. Fugate wrote in a letter in which he confessed the hoax, "I received your letter in regard to those plates, and I will say in answer that they are a humbug gotten up by Robert Wiley, Bridgewitten, and myself." The plates were lost during the Civil War, but in the 1960s, one of them was found in the Chicago Historical Society Museum. Extensive scientific tests have proven that it is a forgery. Thus, Smith, again, was caught lying about his ability to translate ancient languages. Again, seems to be a pattern here, right? Seems to be a pattern. It's not just one incident. It's one after another. But you see how, and this isn't just true of Mormons. This is true of every one of us. You see how susceptible we are to believe things that seemingly conform with our particular worldview. You know, because people, you know, Mormon leaders said that this demonstrated the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. They were desperately looking for evidence that would, you know, not only convince themselves but others that the Book of Mormon is true, even though it wasn't. And all this is not just, again, a problem for the followers of Mormonism. This is a problem for mankind. We all are a little bit prone to believe things that conform to our worldview, whether they're true or not. And understanding that, we just need to take precautions. You know, there are many times where, of course, a lot of us get our news anymore from Facebook feeds, and people post things, and there's a whole lot of things that I skip right over and ignore, assuming they're inaccurate. Matter of fact, part of me tells me that's just not true, even though, you know, it would kind of conform and fit with my particular worldview, that Obama bad, conservative good. Matter of fact, I've come to realize that some of these sources are unreliable, because it usually will say where this article has come from. And it's not Fox News, you know, it's not the Trib Star, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, it's some other whacked out source. And so all I'm saying is check things out, even whenever you suspect that information is correct, check it out first. I've noticed a lot of my friends on Facebook specifically anymore are posting something and saying, is this true? You know, before I say something, is this true? Is this accurate? And many times you'll find it's not. So let's not be gullible, is what I'm saying. Understand our own propensity to believe things that conform with our worldview. And one of the things they taught me in public schools, and they probably did this to overthrow what was culturally acceptable in that day, but they taught critical thinking. You know, you don't just read something and believe it. You know, you think critically about it. And so Mormons need to do this, but so do we as Christians. It says here on page 105, then, in spite of the fanciful nature of Joseph Smith's story and his shady character, the Mormon church gradually grew, which is just baffling. You know, some of you are younger. Some of you have been around as long as I have. And to me, it's just amazing that there's so many different, you know, beliefs even within Christianity. You know, I was thinking recently because I was communicating with someone who appears to be saved, appears to be surrendered to the Lord, zealous, you know, for the truth, opposes error, you know, so shares all those things with myself, and yet we disagree on some very important matters. And, the psychologist in me is always asking, why? Why? And there's probably not just one easy answer to that question, but I'm always asking myself, why? You know, sometimes we get stuck in the tradition that we grow up with, but some people grow up in the truth. I would like to think that that's true of my children. You know, sometimes, like, let me give you an example, you know, about the Bible issue. You know, how come people disagree on the Bible issue? You know, I wasn't so much brought up under a King James-only position. I mean, in the churches that I attended early in life, they all used the NIV. You know, they were Southern Baptist churches. And I think after 1971, which was the year I was born, all the Southern Baptist churches used the NIV. So as a young person, the two churches that I recall attending, that's what they used. But when we started going to Grafton, that's not what they used. And so I learned the reasons why the traditional texts are used in the King James Bible. But why is there a difference of opinion? And to me, it comes down to authority. You know, my authority is the Bible, and I think that some people's authority isn't the Bible. Some people put a great deal of confidence in textual scholars and in higher criticism to find for us the right text that belongs. Anyway, I probably shouldn't even bring that up. It's just something I think about, something I want you to think about. Why are there differences of opinions? Why are there differences even within Christianity? Why are there people who wholeheartedly believe that the Book of Mormon is divine revelation, and there are people who don't believe that? Why? There's a lot of reasons, but I think it's fruitful to think about why and to know ourselves so that we're not deceived. But here it says, Smith gained only a small group of followers in his home area of New York. His work was much hindered by his reputation and that of his family. The following testimony was given to a newspaper in Palmyra, New York, and is dated March 12, 1831. The Gold Bible, in quotes, question excites but little interest in this section of the country, its followers being few and generally of the dregs of community and the most unlettered people that can be found anywhere. And besides, there is much reason to doubt the sincerity of many of them. The first idea of a book was doubtless suggested to the Smith by one Walters, a juggling fortune teller who made the ignorant believe that an old book in his possession in the Latin language contained an account of antediluvians, and the word was given out that the book Smith was about to find was a history of hidden treasures. Smith and his fathers belonged to a gang of money diggers who had followed that business for many years, Joel pretending he could see the gold and silver by the aid of what he called a peep stone. So, of course, this, I guess the point here is this may have been one of the reasons they moved. And they moved from New York to Kirtland, Ohio. Brigham Young joined the Mormons there and was ordained as an elder. The Mormons built their first temple in Kirtland. They also started a bank called the Kirtland Safety Society Bank. Smith gave a prophecy that the bank would swallow up all other banks and would prosper greatly. Shady financial dealings soon brought the wrath of the people upon them. And Smith was arrested 7 times in 4 weeks and was convicted of operating a bank without a state charter. So I think it's about time for us to quit, though. So we'll pick up there. We'll have Tom pick up from there. He can come back. Page number 106. Anybody got any further questions or comments about it?